Welcome to Done and Done. I'm Alicia, your hostess on this podcast journey where we explore and connect the expanse of Dominic Dunn's universe. I am coming to you today a little bit pollen affected from springtime here in Atlanta, Georgia, but this week we are continuing to flap our wings, swimming with the swans. Coming into Alicia's version of episode 4 of Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, currently airing on FX and Hulu. In today's podcast, we're going to take a half-and-half approach. First up, we're going to sum up the episode 4 you saw, and then pick up the thread with, I think, the most interesting part of the episode. For me, that is the introduction of Kate Harrington, John O'Shea's daughter. Kate is introduced here in this episode. That part is true, although it happens a bit differently. In the second half of our podcast episode today, we're going to pull an episode out of the Patreon vault for Kate Harrington to tell her own story, her real story, which does add so much into the context of Truman Capote as a person and their relationship. Before we begin this one, I do have my eyes on a few fine folks who need some tremendous thanks. Time for Shout Out Corner, My Eye Spies. Dharma Amy, CamDZ97, TPWNYC, and Reading in the South, thank you, all of you, for your fine reviews over on the Apple Podcasts. That really, really made my week. I really appreciate y'all. Kind reviews and emails are always appreciated. Got a few more shout-outs to give to our most recent supporters over at patreon.com/doneanddone. Amanda B., Librarian Barbie, Neely M., Amy F., Jen, and Janelle K., huge thanks to you new folks. Huge thanks to sustaining Patreon members. Y'all are the magic, and I am so thankful for you. So many spiderwebs coming in today's episode, y'all. I promise, Kate is so much more than what we have been shown on the screen so far. Let's investigate. Wowza, investigators, we are almost halfway through Feud. Season 2, Capote vs. the Swans, and in this one, episode 4, I'm not really sure how to feel. There's a lot shown in the episode that sort of happened-ish in ways. I think in the last episodes here on the podcast, I'm happy we went into some of these stories from the real players involved in further detail. Let's go ahead and thank Fletcher Peters from the Daily Beast once again for this nice little wrap-up, though I am going to do a little bit of Alicia's version along the way a bit. From Fletcher Peters, Entertainment Reporter, this was published February 14th, 2024. Headline reads, A Vulture in Swan's Clothing. Subhead, one of Truman's swans has been deceiving her friends this entire time. When will the other ladies recognize the enemy among them? Babe's cancer treatments are failing. In the latest episode of Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, we learn that her tumors aren't shrinking, and Babe hates radiation treatment, so what's the point in continuing? Her doctor wants her to keep going. Bill still wants to be with her and has a plan for her recovery. But Babe is more focused on figuring out how to make the best of the time she still has in this world, rather than trying to elongate it. Which is why when Slim asks the Swans to boycott Truman's revival of his famed black and white party, Babe finally protests against the stalemate. Babe has had enough of this tension between her friends. CZ agrees with Babe. They need to have a friendship truce. Princess Margaret, Richard Nixon, and Fidel Castro will be in attendance. Shouldn't they then be there as well? Slim is infuriated by this betrayal from her friends. Truman is a cockroach, she says. They'll never be able to kill him. This is some pretty harsh stuff. Across town, back to Fletcher Peters. Truman finalizes his list of invitees for the soiree with current partner John. Walter Cronkite and Jodie Foster earned spots on the list. As the men continue to rattle off potential guests, John grows upset with Truman, who continuously teases him. That's what couples do, they banter. But John can't take a joke, once again resorting to violence and anger as a way to get Truman to stop talking. Truman needs to escape this abusive relationship. All of that is most assuredly true. We have unpacked much of the violence and toxicness of Truman and John O'Shea's relationship in previous episodes. Also, that resurrection of the second black and white ball was going to happen in the late 1970s. It was going to be in a different country. We've unpacked that one as well. Back to the Daily Beast. Also in the toxic relationship department is this hot new couple, Slim and Bill, who are having a treacherous affair behind Babe's back. Slim has become the real enemy of the Swans, ripping them away from their closest friend and forcing Truman into a spiral of alcoholism while also betraying Babe, who has been her ally this entire time. Slim convinces Bill to keep Babe away from Truman, as if she hasn't done enough. Slim is also suing Truman for defamation. A few days later, Truman has an eventful dinner. He's confronted by Slim, who uses reverse psychology to sway Truman away from inviting Babe to the upcoming ball. She dares Truman to do it. Babe is going to hurt him even more if he does. Babe loathes you, Truman, Slim snarks. You are not in the picture. You are not in her life. You are not in the will, and none of that will ever change because you are incapable of change. Damn, Slim is a vulture in swan's clothing. Now, I will tell you that Slim and Bill Paley did have an affair, but that's not even the most exciting or most intriguing of Bill Paley's affairs. For any of my Trashy Royals listeners this week, we have been investigating the very long and very trashy tale of Lord and Lady Mountbatten, Edwina and Dickie. Let me tell you about that time Bill Paley had an affair concurrently while married to his first wife with both Lady Edwina Mountbatten and Pamela Churchill, then daughter-in-law to Winston, long before she adopted her Hayward and Harriman last names. Bill Paley, notorious philanderer. All right, let's go ahead and find out what else happens in this episode. During that same evening, Truman has a more calming chat with his ex, Jack, who urges Truman to go to rehab. After that conversation with Slim, Truman is comforted by this calming presence and agrees to go. Jack also forces Truman to get rid of John. A redemption arc is coming. Slim digs herself into an even deeper hole, calling gossip columnist Liz Smith to pen a scathing expose about Truman's ball shaping up to be a total failure. But CZ has already chatted with Liz, apparently, and she has given Truman's party planning skills a rave review. Still, Slim has more sway over Liz and convinces her to write the hit piece. Later, CZ begs Slim to stop planting blind items about Truman's party. Truman is in rehab, for God's sakes, give him a break. Truman does complete a number of rehabilitation stays during the latter years of his life. Again, CZ, his truest friend, Carol Marcus, same way. Joanne Carson, very much in that picture too. Back to the Daily Beast. CZ and Joanne visit Truman at rehab. He's doing much better, working on different art pieces with new friends he's met. Not long after, Truman returns home with Jack, who has cleaned the entire apartment and thrown out all the alcohol. Truman is really on the road to recovery. Jack promises to help Truman. They may not be partners anymore, but they'll be friends forever. Jack says he feels more like a brother to Truman than anything else. Truman pledges to stay healthy, although he does warn that working on his ongoing manuscript is going to be a bit of a nightmare. Running out of allies, Slim turns to Lee, who became one of Truman's fiercest adversaries after the Esquire piece smeared the Swans' names. But even Lee has turned and advises Slim to stop attacking everyone around her, especially Babe. Lee insists that Slim end her affair with Bill, but Slim says it's not really an affair, but rather a friendship. Lee rolls her eyes. Slim ends the lunch with a threat. What happens when Truman gets to the Lee Radziwill chapter of his slanderous book? Somehow, everyone has picked up on this affair between Slim and Bill, even Babe. But Babe has no ill feelings toward either of the two. In fact, she approves of this relationship. Babe tells Bill he should find love after she's gone, and Slim is the perfect new wife. But this only scares Bill away from Slim. Now that Babe knows and is acting quite weird about the affair, Slim and Bill finally agree to end it. As hard as Jack may try to bring some normalcy to Truman's life, Truman Capote will always be Truman Capote. Not long after his return from rehab, Truman goes on a bender, breaking his sobriety with a boatload of alcohol and his old fling, John, who is now back in the picture. Jack bids his final farewell to the unfixable Truman. A few weeks later, Truman is visited by a confusing guest, Carrie O'Shea, John's daughter. I do want to Alicia's version here connect in that this is Ella Beatty playing the role of Kate Harrington, the daughter of Annette Bening and Warren Beatty. Truman has finally cut John out of his life, but that is exactly why Carrie is visiting. She wants to bond with Truman over their shared disdain for her horrible father, while also using him to get a job within and advice about the writing world. Truman takes a liking to Carrie, adopting her as his mentee. He finds her a job in modeling and tells her to start taking notes about the conversations in her life. Talk, Truman says, is where all the secrets live. That part kind of mostly did happen. That's the second part of our episode today. Concluding here from the Daily Beast, and this just didn't happen. So again, there's some parts in the watching of Feud that you not only have to suspend disbelief, but knowledge, but let's go ahead and wrap it up. At this point in the episode, we cut between Babe and Truman at similar breaking points in their lives. Both speak with their shrink, upset about the divide in their relationship. Babe is happy her life is almost over, but now she wants to reconnect with everything she's disconnected with. Truman is delighted by his new friend, Carrie, but there may only be hope in his life if he finishes this book. Babe keeps dreaming about seeing Truman, always in the same situation. They get lunch in Paris, it's snowing, and they just sit with one another, happy to be together again. When Babe and Truman finally meet up, it feels like a dream. It had to have been a dream because it was a dream. Truman, who is in the middle of shopping with Carrie, spots Babe on the street. He runs to her. They chat about the dress Babe has been eyeing in the window. Truman tells Babe he canceled the black and white party. Babe compliments Truman on this decision. He should never repeat himself. They hug. This hug is the best moment of the season thus far. It's so tender, quiet, subtle. Truman's hand clings to Babe's fur coat. But they must release one another. The episode ends as Babe wraps up her speech about Truman to her therapist. He was the love of my life, she says, finally letting go of him. Be that as it may, much of this episode happened-ish, but it was not quite like that in real life. The most interesting thing I can offer you this week is the real story of Kate Harrington, John O'Shea's daughter. We got introduced to her in this episode under her given name, Carrie O'Shea. This one is coming to you from Kate Harrington herself. I need y'all to get ready for some off-the-charts spiderwebs and connections. We are going to take a quick break here. When we return, you will hear the intro music and then a Not Done Yet from back in the month of February. What is Kate Harrington's real story? See you on the flip. Hey, 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 investigators. It is Alicia. It is a rainy day here in my little studio. I got Inman sleeping on the studio table, and I have an amazing story for y'all today. We have made it into the C block of Truman versus the Swans. We've talked about John O'Shea in this Not Done Yet, number 80. I do want to spend a minute with John O'Shea's daughter. Kate Harrington is her name, and I don't know, again, where the story's going to go as I'm recording this, which is Monday, February 12th, in advance for dropping it this weekend for you. I have seen episodes 1 and 2. I haven't watched 3. 4's coming out this week, but this particular bit, it's going to go long, but I think it might be well worth putting here. Because, whoa, spiderwebs, friends, spiderwebs. In George Plimpton's Truman Capote, in which various friends, enemies, acquaintances, and detractors recall his turbulent career. I can't tell you what an incredible, incredible resource this is. We're going to be using this a whole bunch to fill in some of the real truths around Capote and his Swans. There is a particular chapter here, chapter 34, in which Kate Harrington, John O'Shea's daughter, tells her story. From what I've seen so far, I don't know if the story we're seeing on the Swans is necessarily the truth. Again, I don't know where it's going to go, but these pages were really pretty incredible. And I think Kate's voice here and talking about her dad and Truman and where Truman took her and what she saw is well worthwhile. You're going to hear a lot of names in here from our cast of characters in the Dominic Dunn universe. It's really incredible. This is Kate Harrington telling her story to George Plimpton. Truman was my father's lover. I met him in my mother's living room. I was raised out on Long Island and came from a very ordinary Irish middle-class family. We lived this very conventional life. My mother and father had 4 children. My father was 42 years old in 1972, when somehow or another, and I'm still not sure how, he and Truman connected. I've heard many different stories. Very funny, they all make me laugh now. My father's version was that he was always a frustrated writer. A banker at Marine Midland, he used to come home at night and go downstairs to write. We never knew what he was writing. Just a typical frustrated writer. He was a very smart, self-taught man. He read a lot. Supposedly, what he did was send Truman a bunch of letters and things he'd written, which Truman even confirmed. But it's hard to believe that Truman answered, because when I lived with Truman, we used to get his mail and throw it in the incinerator. So I doubt he read my father's things. That was my father's story, that he called him and asked to come see him. That doesn't seem likely. It seems like my father must have led a bit of a double life. Truman used to say, oh no, he did write me as it were, but he met me at some men's gay bathhouse on the Upper East Side. That probably is more true. My parents had a hard marriage. Anyway, my dad came home one day and sat us all down as a family and said, I'm going to leave the bank and go to work as a business manager for Truman Capote. The rest of the kids didn't say anything. And I said, who's Truman Capote? You know, excuse me, I was 11 at the time. My father, who was sort of a teacher of all of us, was furious. I didn't know who Truman Capote was. He's a well-known writer, blah, blah, blah. For about a year, my dad supposedly worked for Truman and traveled around the world with him. My parents stayed married. Because he had been sort of unhappily married to my mother, everyone was very happy about this, because my father was finally happy. He would come home and Truman would come to our house for dinners on Sundays, all very kind of jolly. My mother loved Truman. He was pretty irresistible. That's how I got to know him, sort of suspiciously, because I was very close to my father and I thought, who is this guy? Anyway, we came to know him in that way, the whole family. He was an uncle figure. I remember the first gift he ever brought when he came to Wantagh. He gave us gifts that I understand completely now, what people didn't need. I was from a you'll get a new pair of shoes at Christmas kind of family, a middle class family. The whole concept of giving gifts as a gesture or because they're just beautiful was something new to me. He bought me this big rock of amethyst. I thought it was the Hope Diamond. I would carry it around, this big sparkly thing. I thought, how amazing. There's this whole other world out there where people think of things like this. You give a gift just because it's pretty to look at. It was really a big change. He gave my mother that observations book by Richard Avedon. No one spoke of his homosexuality in my family, or to be honest, at that point in my life, I don't think I even knew what a homosexual was. I didn't know what was going on. I was a young 11. I was happy that my mother was happy and my dad was happy and we liked Truman. He was funny and all that, but he changed our lives without a doubt, but in a nice way. My dad sent these postcards from all over the world, being with the Agnellis and visiting the Chaplains. It was like my father was living a kind of My Fair Lady-esque life. I think my mom was in denial that they were lovers. Finally, one day, my mother heard something about my father, that he had started to get into drugs. Living in Key West for the winter, Truman and Dad, he had gotten involved in cocaine. Truman told my mother about it because my father had become really violent and loud. My mother was very innocent and really believed being involved with drugs was the worst thing in the world. She was so terrified she decided to leave my dad. They got separated. Everything got pretty bleak for my poor mother. She began to work. She'd been a housewife. She got a job at a law book publishing firm out in Long Island, but she didn't make much money. The two eldest children sort of fled, so it was the little brother, Christopher, I, and my mom. It was a very dark period. My mother was very Miss Havisham about things. Things got terrible with money, really terrible. No money, no heat, and just dreadful. My mother essentially had a breakdown and she began to drink. I had turned 12. When you come from a hard family, you're very grown up at 12. So I rang Truman. His number was always up on the wall above the phone in the kitchen. "Hi, it's Carrie, and I wondered if I could talk to you about something." He did this adorable thing. He acted as if he was making an appointment with an adult. He said, "Okay, why don't you come in on the train?" I'd never come into New York on my own, ever. He told me how to do it and how to give the cab driver a note that read 870 UN Plaza. So I snuck out, didn't tell my mom, and went to New York. And we had this lunch at Antolotti's on 49th Street, just the two of us. I said, "Look, I know you know a lot of important people, and I really need a good job because my mom needs money." I explained the whole situation to him. I said I wasn't asking him for money, but from all the stories he told us, I figured someone could use a helper. Truman said, "Well, let me think about it. Are you willing to quit school?" I was in seventh grade. He said that smart people don't need to go to school, which was obviously his own situation. I said, no. "Let me think about it for a week," he said, "and you come back this time next week." So I did that, cut school and did it again. Truman said, "The only thing someone who's this young can do is be a model." I came from a family which exalted reading and writing, very first generation. Study, study, study. A real Irish household in the sense that they don't overflatter you. So I was stunned because I wasn't very secure about modeling. After he convinced me that was a possibility, he helped me. He invited me to come and see his friend Wilhelmina, who ran the modeling agency. At the first meeting, she said, "I have a Carrie O'Neill. Carrie O'Shea's a little too similar. Any other name?" I remember looking at Truman and thinking, "What do you mean, any other name? I had never heard of anyone changing their name. I grew up in a dumb little town where no one changed their name unless they got married." He said, Well, her mother's name is Harrington. Anyway, before you knew it, by the time we walked out, my name had been changed from Carrie O'Shea to Kate Harrington, and it's never come back. To be honest, it did bother me, though I'm very proud of my mother's side of the family, where I'm not of my dad's. The Harringtons are a very nice, big family, very smart, people to be proud of. The O'Shays are a small family, whom I never knew, and my dad had a very dicey reputation all around. So I think it was kind of great for me to detach, though it got me into a lot of trouble with some of the people in my town and my brothers, thinking I was acting puffed up and all that. Well, let's just shoot an amazing portfolio for you, Truman said. I wasn't the prettiest girl on the block, but I was thin. Richard Avedon photographed me in my school uniform. I couldn't imagine anyone wanting me to be a model, but I just believed Truman. All these famous photographer friends of his shot this portfolio. Avedon, Victor Skrebneski, Scavullo, they were doing him a favor. When I would go out on go-sees, people used to say, "Who are you? How'd you get all these pictures?" Truman always said that I should refer to him as an old friend of the family. An old friend of what family? My family's from the Bronx. More and more, I would stay at Truman's. He was often gone. He'd be with my dad, who was never in New York when I was there. I think he was afraid my mother would serve him with divorce papers, and he stayed in Palm Springs. I'm grateful now, but then it was very confusing because I didn't belong anywhere. I have all this in my journals. The day I went to stay with Truman, he handed me a black and white composition book, and he said, "This is what kept me alive during my adolescence. Keep writing in a journal. You can't stay with me unless you keep one." So I did. It's very funny to read, full of spelling mistakes. The day I went to see Avedon, I would misspell his name. I went to see a photographer today, who Truman said is very famous. I would describe the whole thing in the journal. There was a big umbrella with a light bulb in it. Very naive and funny. Or I'd go see really famous people with Truman, wonderful people. And I'd say, "They're some of the most unhappy people I've ever met." Isn't that something? I went back to Long Island every Friday to take my tests at school, and then I'd spend the weekend there. We're not talking the Hamptons. We're talking Gateway to Jones Beach. Wanta, which Truman used to laughingly refer to as Wonderful Wanta. He'd say, "And how wonderful Wanta was this weekend," and he'd just howl with laughter. It was so surreal, because one day you'd be having lunch with the Kissingers, and they'd be asking you, "Oh, do you have a beau?" And da-da-da-da-da-da, and then I'd go home, and this, ugh, just a nightmare. But I loved my mother very, very much. As time went on, it was very My Fair Lady, where you didn't fit in either place fully, but so it is. The first time I walked into that apartment with this beautiful view of the East River right next to the UN on the 22nd floor, for someone like me, it was a real gasper. That feeling didn't go away for a long time. The whole apartment had that kind of view. His room was at the very end of a little hallway, and mine was right next to it, a little peach-colored room, a beautiful little daybed right by the window, very simple and plain, with pillows. He also had a desk in there where he used to write and talk to people on the phone. It had beautiful taffeta curtains that were lavender. It was very peaceful and simple. Lots and lots of books sent to him to review, tons of picture books. The paperweights were in the living room, millions of beautiful paperweights with all these bursts of colors. I never got tired of looking at those. The whole idea of collecting things was so wonderful. It's funny how you go through a period where something startles you for a long time and you think it's so interesting and precious, and finally it makes sense, and then you're looking for paperweights. He had three stuffed snakes, which were so icky, but you got used to them. He had this thing about reptiles. He had those needlepoint pillows with sayings on them, and he had H go lightly on the door of my room. I had never seen Breakfast at Tiffany's. I watched the movie recently, and it made me laugh, because a lot of the things Truman taught me are strictly from that character. The whole idea of diamonds are tacky before you're 40 and all that stuff. Truman didn't have a television set. I remember when I first came in the apartment at 870 UN Plaza, I said, "Well, what are you supposed to do here?" He had this big, vast apartment. I used to walk around and look at all the paintings all day and the knickknacks. I said, "There's not even a television." He brought me to this little red room with all these books, and he said, "There's your television. Read those." All those picture books he had. I really believe that's how I ended up being interested in pictures, because I just used to sit out of boredom and look endlessly at these pictures and read and read. He changed my entire life because he had me read everything. I came home one day in the seventh grade and I said, "I have to write a book report and I don't know what book to read." He said, "Read Out of Africa." So I did a book report on Out of Africa, and my provincial seventh grade teacher, nobody had heard of it. In the eighth grade, I had a clever teacher. Truman said, "Let's do a book report on In Cold Blood." He brought out the old real pictures of the real murderers, his little Pandora's box of Dick and Perry. How hilarious to be out in Wantagh saying, "And here are the murderers." My teacher couldn't believe it. He grabbed me at the end of class and said, "Where did you get all this stuff?" It was so funny, really too funny. I was like, "Oh, I'm friends with the man who wrote that book." All the way through high school, that teacher was always asking, "How are you?" What amazes me now is that I convinced the school board, a Catholic school out on Long Island, that it was a great opportunity for me to have a career, that going to school was nonsense, and they said, "Yeah." I did pass my courses at school. I ended up studying at night, and then I would take the quizzes on Friday. I passed. It was easy. I think what was uncomfortable was not being part of a school and always being an adult. I would go through these little rebellions where I really hated modeling, and I would tell Truman, "I don't want to do this anymore." I joined the boys' high school track team and ran on the team. I was quick. I was good. In fact, it was my whole life when I was young. I used to run every single day and night. I ran the 1,500 meters. Crazy. Truman was such a multifaceted person, and all his self-destructiveness aside, he had one of the biggest insights of anybody I'd ever met. He was a very complex person who could be a million things. There was a decided part of him that was like a child who had never grown up, so that was the friendship he gave me. He taught me in a very gentle, understated way. He would never embarrass me. There was a part of him that was incredibly sensitive. He must have watched a lot of behavior or read a lot of things from books himself. If you think about where he's from, down in rural Alabama, people down there weren't really hanging around with Babe Paley. As I look back, and it's been many years, I'm sure that he identified with me more than I realized. I didn't understand that before because he was so exalted and everything. My parents were really strict, so I think manners went a long way. I don't think he would have had me around if I didn't have decent manners and was clunking around, bumping into things. The sad thing is, I always felt the first few years that I was walking around on eggshells. Not because he demanded that, but if I put one foot wrong staying in his apartment, I wouldn't have my job and then I'd have to go back, doomed to a life sentence in wonderful Wantagh. He absolutely taught me everything about dress. He was great friends with Halston and those people. His idea that fascinated me was that dresses should be very plain and always the same for a woman. He would say, "Always keep your hairstyle the same and never change it," and all that. Then I would meet those women with him, Babe Paley or Mary Lazar in California or whatever. I mean, I can just imagine the whispers at dinner that I never heard. "Oh, it's that mean boyfriend's daughter. I'm sure they felt poor thing, but it could have been worse. He was a lovely person and he couldn't have been sweeter no matter what his motivation was. Truman never forced me to do anything. I think he was just trying to help me be something, and he couldn't think of anything besides what he did for me. It's extraordinary that we ended up staying so close all the way to the very end of his life, because I don't think he expected that either. I never thought of him as my dad at all. He was very much a friend on one hand. I was used to having alcoholic parents. There's a thing that happens, role reversal, where you're their friend and their comrade. They're not looking after you. It's more equal or you become the parent. That very much happened at the end with Truman, where I got to pay him back for looking after me because he had no friends. It wasn't awkward for me. We sat in on rainy days. He'd have these long legal yellow pads and he'd say, "All right, you write a story and then I'll write a story." And then we'd switch and read them. I was so naive and not really that well read. I didn't even know that he was such a great writer. I figured that was his job. He wrote books for Random House. He'd say, "Okay, you say a sentence and I'll say a sentence, and then we'll have to write the stories." And that's how it went. He'd say, "There was a woman who lived in Shanghai and her name was Beatrice Bald and da da da, and I had to make a story out of that." And then I'd say one to him. We'd switch and read. When I think of having the nerve to give him one of my stories, how embarrassing. Mostly it was humorous, though. So much laughter and cynicism. He had a side to him, which was probably his downfall, as is the case with most alcoholics, that is that he had a thread of sensitivity that was maybe just too sensitive. Truman once said to me when he was at the hospital for the millionth time drying out, something about the glare of life being too much for some of us. I always remember that. His struggle with all of that was very sad and hard to deal with. He would try so hard and get all cleaned up, really healthy, drinking cases and cases of tab, and he'd want to be fabulous and all that, and I understand that so much now. Then he'd start slipping and he'd say, "Don't let me have any more of these," and he'd hand me the pills. I'd have them under my pillow when I went to bed. My room was next to his. And then he'd come in at 2 or 3 in the morning and he'd say, "You have to give them to me." We'd have this argument and I'd say no, and he was just so sad. Looking back on it, I see how strange it was that he never found dates for me. That's a typical kind of gay thing. He would talk about people who theoretically would be good for me. He set his sights a little high for me. He wanted me to be with the sons of the women he knew, really powerful women, who had married very powerful men or men who were very rich, the sons of the really elegant wives of these kinds of men. Until I was about 17, he would act like I was too young to date. I went out with a boy from my hometown who had moved up to Connecticut. I went out with him for about 5 years. Truman didn't disapprove, but he didn't approve either. One time he wanted me to go to the Winston Guests for the weekend where Diana Vreeland was supposed to be. He said, "This is a really good opportunity and you should go." I don't know what possessed me, but obviously I was feeling pushed around. I opted for a boring weekend in Westport, Connecticut with my boyfriend and his family instead of going out to the Guests to see Mrs. Vreeland. I just couldn't bear another weekend with all of the adults yakking away. I remember fighting with him. The only thing that ever made him upset is when I missed opportunities that he deemed to be opportunities. I was like a sponge for about 15 years, but I didn't know where I fit in comfortably because I'm a fairly honest person and I don't do well masquerading. I have too much of this Irish grit in me to really do that for too long. I remember he brought me to Richard Avedon's opening at the Metropolitan Museum of Arts, his retrospective. He said to me on the way over, "Now don't tell anyone where you're from. Don't tell anyone that you're from Wanta. I felt this was a huge betrayal because I started to think that there was something wrong with my beginnings. I thought, gee, he's really ashamed of where I'm from. I can see that what he was trying to do was mastermind some plan. The My Fair Lady thing. Just say I'm an old friend of the family's, he said, and I said okay, but that's pretty sad. My mother wouldn't like that. As I got older, I began to see that the people at parties like Mr. Avedon's opening were an insular little group who liked to believe that everybody was somebody they sort of understood. I resigned myself to the fact that it was just easier, but that was a very difficult thing for me to undo after he was gone. To see that it's much more important for peace of mind to authentically be yourself. We went to California a couple of times. I'd never been on a plane, and I'd certainly never been to California. We stayed at the Beverly Wilshire. We'd get to the hotel, and he'd say, "Let's have a nap in the afternoon." I didn't want to have a nap. I had all the energy I needed. So I would just walk around or go to bookstores. Then we'd get ready for the evenings. We went to these dinner parties every night in Bel Air. Until I thought all they did in California was go to each other's living rooms and have lunch and dinner. Truman decided I was going to be an actress. Truman had this whole Hollywood connection, Swifty Lazar, Carol Mathau. He sent me to Halston, who was nice enough to give me all of these beautiful little frocks that were too sophisticated for me. My mom was all excited, butterflies in the stomach. She packed me away. Truman was going to introduce me to Sue Mangers, the biggest agent on the coast. I mean, the whole idea was so silly. When a camera gets on me, forget it. I'm not supposed to be on that end of the camera. I was crippled by self-doubt, completely a wreck. Besides, I wasn't ambitious in that way. I had a certain amount of star quality, Truman always used to say, but I think a lot of people have that little spark inside them. Enthusiasm and who knows where the heck it came from? You're sort of born with it. But he interpreted it as true star quality. For me, it was more like a love of life. He didn't understand the essential little Irish girl, humble Catholic, that I couldn't outgrow. You can't live on someone else's fuel. So he took me out there. They had a series of dinner parties in my honor. I remember saying to him on the plane out, "Why do all your friends always have dinners for someone? Can't they just have dinner? Why would they have a dinner for me? They don't even know me." At the first party, all these people were there. I was so crippled. I was dressed in this flowy chiffon thing, two pieces of chiffon, a navy and white thing that Halston had made, and these little slippers. I came floating in with Truman into one of those sunken Los Angeles living rooms, and there was Sammy Davis Jr. and Ryan O'Neill and all these people, and I was like, oh my God. Back in New York, Henry Kissinger, Norman Mailer, and all those people were real. I could deal with that. I got very comfortable with all the Park Avenue ladies, but this was just too much. I walked in and I thought, oh dear God in heaven, saying hello to all these faces that in my hometown, the people used to stay glued to People magazine to look at. Everybody paired off and went into the living room. Everybody had to be walked in by someone else, which I now understand, but back then I was thinking, don't worry, I can get in there by myself. They said I should walk in with Ryan O'Neill. I had seen Love Story with my sister in the local theater, and I remember we went into the bathroom and cried over Ally McGraw dying. It was a little much for me, being escorted by Ryan O'Neill into the dining room. Someone had made a mistake about Sammy Davis Jr. being there. He didn't get along at all. He had probably said some mean things about Truman or something. They shouldn't have invited him. It was a nightmare because even as far away as they put him from Truman, Truman got plastered and started saying things down the table. Then Ryan O'Neill decided he had a crush on me. I was 15 or 16 and he was 36 or something. He said, "Can I drop Kate off, Truman? I want her to meet Tatum." Truman was like, "Well, that's entirely up to her." But then he stepped back from Ryan and waved, "No, no." I remember Mary Lazar taking me into the loo with her. All of this is in my journal, where I wrote, "They call the bathroom the loo, and she was very sweet. She said, remember one thing. No matter what Truman tells you about who you should be with, the only thing that matters when you're with a man is that they have a good sense of humor and that they have a good heart." I've had lots of men like me all my life, and the happiest I've ever been is with Swifty, and look at him. She was quite pretty, and it struck me immediately. What is she doing with this little bald man with the big glasses and everything? Every night there was a different party. Jan Cushing, Mary and Swifty Lazar. I remember Swifty asking me, "Can you sing? Can you dance? Well, what can you do?" I said, "I don't know." Thank God I never did a screen test. I never wanted to be an actress. I had no interest, none. I like going to movies. That's it. Modeling was fine because I loved being in Mademoiselle and 17, but it was really because I was proud of myself to be the breadwinner. I was proud for my mom and my best girlfriend to see my picture, but I also was not stupid. I knew I wasn't 6 feet tall. I didn't care about being a star model. It was just a means to an end. But with the acting, I put my foot down because I knew it would embarrass me. I was very strong-willed. I would never let someone push me into something. Also, Truman was becoming less of an authority figure because his life was slipping down. I was starting to take care of him, so I wasn't taking every stitch of advice anymore. I said, "Truman, you don't understand. I don't want to do this. I have no desire to do it, none, and I have no talent. I'm not going to make a fool of myself. What are you going to do? Give me singing lessons? I don't want to sing." And he was like, "All right, I was just trying to help." So he let it go. Y'all, Kate Harrington, did you catch a load? I wanted to read the whole thing. I wanted to read the whole thing without interruption, but did you catch a load of all of that? Truman, the relationship with Jack O'Shea, My Fair Lady, H. Go Lightly on Her Door, The Peach Room, Richard Avedon, Halston, Sue Mangers, Mary Lazar, wife of Swifty, Swifty Lazar, already talked about, Carol Marcus, holy cat, Sammy Davis Jr., Ryan O'Neill, love story. Oh, God, it's just too much how it all connects. Oh, Out of Africa? Oh, yeah, I did my book report on In Cold Blood. Isn't that the most amazing story you've ever heard? Again, I don't know particularly how they're going to use Jack O'Shea's children within Truman Capote versus the Swans, but I would be remiss if I did not give y'all that story in its entirety as a little fill-in in between Block 3 and Block D. That's Kate. I don't know when or where she's coming back, but I thought that story was just simply too good not to be shared with y'all, my favorite investigators. Wasn't that kind of an incredible ride? Alicia, back with you in real time. This episode that you just heard was from Patreon last month, but I do like how this story, Kate's story, ties into a bit of our future episodes when we see her again in episode 6 with Richard Avedon and future Truman Capote. It seems to me that Kate's real story would have been an interesting way to make Truman be seen as an empathetic and sympathetic character through Kate. The Truman caring for her arc and then Kate caring for Truman in his later life, quite an unexpected and tender circle. I do hope you enjoyed that story, and Kate's own perspective adds a bit into your television watching. We are going to be back with a double drop this week. I'm coming in hot for episode 5, Alicia's Version. That is going to be out early and ad-free on Patreon, I think on Tuesday for you this week, my voice depending. It's going to drop for all here on the main feed Friday. Episode 5. Oh boy, a lot to talk about there. I do hope you join me then. Thank you for joining me today, spending your time with me in all the ways you support Done and Done, telling your friends, your kind reviews and emails, your support on Patreon too. Y'all are amazing, simply the best. And until we meet again, you know that I want you to stay curious and keep on investigating. Thanks for listening to the Done and Done podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at doneanddone@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Done and Done Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.doneanddone.com. See you next week, friends.